You ever wonder about the people in family photos or ever try to ask who these people really were? Every face is a narrow escape or a love story that almost didn't happen. Your family stories are hidden in plain view. You just haven't accessed it yet. There are versions of these rebels and dreamers before life told them who they needed to be. And I'm not talking about the shiny stories everyone knows. I'm talking about the soul-crushing experiences with heartbreaks and real loss. You gotta preserve these stories now. So contact thevietnamstorybank.com today. No polish, just raw, recorded, beautiful history that makes you sit up and hold your breath. We dig it all up, record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, unerased, untouchable, and unforgettable. Don't let silence have the last word. Go to vietnamstorybank.com today. Make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today, I have Carl Robinson on with me. This is an interview that I have waited for a long time. You know, you and I have come in contact with each other several times. And you are a big component of the movie The Stringer, directed by Bao Nguyen, now on Netflix. I really advise, encourage everybody to go watch The Stringer. It's an amazing documentary. Carl, you're here because your involvement with The Stringer, but we have a lot more to talk about beyond it, because it's just a tiny chapter in your life. But I do want to know, how has it changed your life after the release of The Stringer?
Well, the Stringer is about the famous Napalm Girl photo of the Vietnam War in Trang Bang in 1972 that went around the world and is credited with ending the war, although I think the war was winding down at that stage anyway. But that was an AP photo, and I was ordered by my boss to put Nick Ut's name, the Vietnamese AP photographer's name, on it. And I carried that burden with me for ages. I mean, I didn't argue with my boss. I had a wife and two kids to worry about and all that in Saigon. And that picture never went away, right? Every generation since 1972 has seen that picture, you know? And even if you don't know who took it or whatever, and in the end, especially when Americans, I mean, the journalism world loves anniversaries, right? So the 50th anniversary in 2022, it all came back again. And I said, gosh, I really can't fight this celebrity machine. I mean, he even went to see the Pope here in Kimpo. And I said, but I've really got to find the photographer who did this. So people know, I'd share that story over the years and say, well, who took it? I say, well, it was a Stringer. And I felt almost ashamed of myself. All I had was like a name, like Turmeric, right? And no Wei Hung or anything, only that he had been in the South Vietnamese army and photographer or cameraman. And then he had left his wife and gone back to get a Yeo Ba, you know, the second wife in Vietnam. I had no idea where he was. And so I was back after COVID and spending a trip, and I met a Vietnamese who had a lot of Facebook followers, and I asked him to help me out. And I put this picture that I had found when I finally went back and looked at all the photos, and I never wanted to look back at it, but it was a real mental thing. And within 48 hours, we found a guy. He was down in Vinh Long, Nguyen Thanh Nghe, and he was, and that's the whole story. And then, I mean, I had not been so happy, maybe at least my later life, right? I've been carrying this burden of being ordered to put somebody else's name on it, and that person becoming famous and well-known and everything. And I felt really, you know, on top of the world, right? Just totally happy. And then when 24 hours later, he had a stroke and almost died, you know, so that elation just bang. And I was praying to the Quan Am to, you know, please help me out. And then 24 hours later, he woke up and he complained about this tube in his mouth and he was moving. Then the film crew was coming back. They had already interviewed me. They were coming back and they said, don't go see him yet. So then the first time I met Nghe was in the hospital. It's in the documentary there. And that, you know, that was, I mean, he was, you know, we were, he was crying, you know, and his daughter, who had come down from California, was, you know, really hysterical in the next room. It was really quite, so for me, that was, you know, it was like meeting a mirror of myself. My wife had told me all these years to forget about it and move on. And Ngay's family had been telling him the same thing. We were like mirrors in the meat. And then, of course, to the documentary people, that's when their work started. So we just, in a lot of ways, went into the background while they backed up our story. We were both convinced that we were right. And then it took until the Sundance Film Festival, January last year, for it to come out. And then most of 2025 for it to be picked up by Netflix, where it is now.
Yeah. And by the way, it just received 4 Emmy nominations a few days ago. So congratulations to Bao Nguyen and the team at Netflix and, you know, for you bringing this story to light.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where, you know, it changed my life in that moment. But then the drama of the next, 2-3 years of putting that together. And then, of course, they even tried to stop it from being shown at Sundance. So last year was just full of controversy. So whatever joy I had, you know, April 3 years ago already, that I met him. So, you know, real up and down feelings. But to answer your question here, you know, it was one of the satisfying things of my life to finally, at the age of 80 something, to get that off my conscience and get the truth out there.
But Carl, I do have a question about that though. You know, as I'm reading and researching about the moment where your boss, a real powerful person at the AP, says to you and whispers in your ear, leans over and whispers in your ear, "I need you to put Nick Ut's name on that role for the submission." When you look back 50 something years later, would you have done it differently?
You know, I think so. I mean, I don't call it a lack of self-confidence, lack of courage or whatever, but maybe I should have just stood right up and said, "No, I'm not going to do that." Right. I mean, I have thought of that, you know, increasingly, that I should have been more brave at the time.
But when we're that young without that many life experiences, we have a wife, we have kids, we have a job, we want to stay in country, we want to do things that provide a sense of sort of like a future for our life. So there's no way that you could at that moment do the calculus to stand up to a powerful boss and say, "You know, I'm not doing that," and lose everything in your life.
Well, one thing that's come up since then is, you know, is how often this happened. Well, the honest answer is it never happened before, right? And that was like the shock of it. We're at the very end of the caption and, you know, and Horst Foss leans in and says, "Nikut, make it Nikut." I mean, it's like poking a knife in you, right? It wasn't like it was a habitual thing. I mean, we weren't stealing bylines left and right there. And it was just, I was really very upset immediately. We had to get the photo out, you know, radio photo to Tokyo and all that sort of thing. And I just made sure Tokyo got that picture an hour later. And then I went home and I was really so pissed off, if you'll pardon my Aussie, that my wife remembered the moment. I rarely shared my work with her. I was just happy to get home at the end of the day.
Mm.
And I didn't know that she remembered until I saw the documentary, in fact. So that's another magical thing there.
You know, I hear your journey and I think about like how we know nothing about what happens behind curtains of journalists working. And you recently started a Substack. You started posting in Substack last August, 2025. And you write a lot about different things about Vietnam. I want to know from your point of view, I think the media landscape is very chaotic now with the new administration, with Trump. How do we know who to believe when we're reading the papers now, when we're reading news or we're watching news? How do you get your how do you get dialed into who's telling the truth?
Well, for one thing, I never believe the first thing I hear. And you, and actually the Substack's been up since August of 2024, actually. So it's been up for 18 months or so, 200 something posts so far. But as an old journalist, I don't really, the only paper I really subscribe to is my local paper in Wollongong, back in Australia, where I've been living since just after the war. And I have a variety. Mainstream media, I just can't even watch it, right? And to say nothing of that shrill female voice that newsreaders have these days, it really rings in the ear. I have a variety you want to talk about Vietnam specifically here.
Yep.
I think as soon as it was interesting, I set up the Substack so that when the Stringer came out, I would have a platform to tell the background of the story. And I was also running excerpts from my memoir, which I published in 2020, about my years in Vietnam from 1964 to 75. And I sort of ran out. The book finally ran its course, and I was thinking of things to write about. And then I started paying more attention to Vietnam, especially with the ascension of Tô Lâm as the new Communist Party boss and what he was doing. I mean, I visited Vietnam, you know, all the time. You know, we have one of those Viet Q visas, and at least once a year, sometimes twice. And the leadership of Vietnam was always pretty amorphous, right? They all looked the same. You had sort of asked, yeah, you know, who's who here? With the three or four pillars that they had, you never knew who was which pillar, you know. But you did have some, well, like Prime Minister Jung, you know, was quite, you know, he was the southerner, you know, who really shook things up with the economy. And then with this guy, when this fellow, I started paying attention, there were a couple of things that happened that really got me stuck into it. When after the Stringer came out, I was interviewed by a female journalist with BBC Vietnamese in Bangkok, and we got to know each other, and you know, we did FaceTime, and then we did a lot of texting back and forth, you know, about, you know, her life in Bangkok. And then she disappeared, and I wanted to get in touch with her and say, look, it might be showing at the Foreign Correspondents Club of Bangkok. You know, are you there? And I had to go through her boss, and said, you know, she's out of touch. And I finally heard from her, and she had gone back to renew her passport, and all her passport and everything was taken away. This is like somebody I knew personally, right? So sort of it really hit home, you know, when that happened to her. And we did get in touch, but she's been banned basically from, I mean, took her ID card away. She can't even travel. And that was really quite seminal to me, to where it brought home personally. You know, I'm reading headlines and all that about another person who had spoken out too much and, you know, and sent into exile or sentenced to imprisonment in Vietnam. But this really brought it home, and I really started paying more attention. And the funny thing was, you know, I'm going to start writing about Vietnam now. The Facebook algorithm suddenly started throwing all these Vietnamese Facebookers at me, right? From the diaspora mostly, but also, you know, in Vietnam. It just, the way the algorithm worked. And suddenly I found this whole world opened up to me. I actually wrote a Substack about how this happened. It's all like with those floods last year and all this stuff coming in. So it gave me material. And of course, you got to judge it, right? You know that, yeah, you're going to have real bias, you know, if you're reading something from Viet Thanh or whoever. But you get a collection of these people, and you just read them all, and you can come to your own balanced opinion and see what's happening there, you know, on the ground, and then just a gut feeling about it. And I do try to be fair. I mean, I wrote what I thought was quite a fair piece about my first piece about Tô Lâm. What did he just loosen up, man? Just, I think a lot of people were hopeful that he would loosen up Vietnam, right? But you know, it's gone quite the contrary, unfortunately. But as far as news in general is concerned, I tend to use Telegram, which was later banned in Vietnam, for a lot of my news, like on where I really started souring on the objectivity of news was with the Ukraine war, frankly, 2022. Where I said, look, this is just, doesn't sound quite right. And I started looking around for more balanced sources out there. And Substack, one of my first contact with Substack was a guy who was writing there with a much more balanced perspective on what was happening there. But my sources of news, because I'm not in a hurry to write like the old journal days, you know, I look at a variety of sources, Telegram and Substack and, you know, Facebookers and people like that, and I sort of balance them up, and then my own, I think I'm quite balanced in what I say.
So how do we know what we're reading, whether it's through Telegram or citizen journalists? How do we gauge who's telling the truth? Because the algorithms make us exist in an echo chamber. If we're conservative, we start getting shown a lot of conservative journalists. And if we're liberal and progressive, we start to see more of that. So how do you start to kind of like whittle down what makes sense and what doesn't to you?
Well, I think you come down to some trusted handful of people, you know, on both sides, you know, on the conservative and the more liberal side, and you trust their judgment. But you can spot, you know, with AI sort of stuff out there, and you can also spot the propaganda. I mean, I think we don't realize how propagandized we are, and I think it's coming very. I think thanks to social media, the world is now seeing what, you know, back in the Vietnam War, we all believed Walter Cronkite, but it doesn't mean Walter Cronkite was necessarily right. But yeah. Now we've learned to question everything, and if you're smart, you're looking at several sources. You say, okay, well, that's kind of funny, but if you got to get at least two or three other people saying that, maybe a government spokesman or, you know, you got to fish around a lot more. And I don't know how junky people are about news anymore. You know, I can graze all day through news stuff, but I think a lot of the danger is a lot of people just get that one source of news and they only watch what they agree with, right?
Yeah. That's a danger.
That's one of my jokes. I only watch news that I agree with. but I think the danger is that people only will only grab one source, or even on cable news, like, you know, they only watch Fox or they only watch CNBC or wherever they are. I don't really watch them, but you've really got to vary your sources, right?
Yeah.
And I've never been a big fan of the establishment, New York Times and Washington Post. That's like a red flag there. You'll find my taking on the New York Times reportage out of Vietnam on my Substacks.
You know, you have
that goes way back to the war days. If they had a story we didn't have at the AP, we got rockets from New York, right? So we had to match them.
You have such a long history with Vietnam. I know that you spent, obviously, you're an American. You grew up as an American, and then you lived in Vietnam during the war and married a Vietnamese woman, and now you live in Australia. And I, you know, often when I read your Substack, I often think about, like, where do you get your news about Vietnam? Because it's just so, it's filled with a lot of details that seem to be coming from sources within Vietnam. And I wonder, you know, are you reading state published news sources, or are you in touch with other sort of journalists in Vietnam?
Oh, I know people in Vietnam, or people who, you know, friends who have contacts inside Vietnam to get a sense of the place, and I've used just to get a feeling,
yeah,
for how things are. But I also find I think my mind is very Vietnamese. I can sense something. And I often sense something and run it past somebody. Yes, you're right. You figured that out. But I just did. I'd like to tell your viewers a bit about my story in Vietnam. I was an exchange student in Hong Kong in 63-64, and that was just after the, well, that was as the Ngo Dinh Diem anti the monk burning and all that was going on, and I was studying international relations, and during the 1 month Chinese New Year 1960 early 64, I decided to go down to South Vietnam to have a look, as one Time magazine guy in Hong Kong said, "See it before it falls." Mm-hmm. This was after the coup. And I went down there, and I fell immediately in love with the place. Like, we came down by ship, and it was all French speaking. I'd grown up in the Congo, the Belgian Congo, and I spoke fluent French. And I felt totally at home. It was like the tropics again. And
wow.
And I was hosted by Vietnamese students who had taken part in the anti-GM protests, and I stayed with them. I was a poor student. I wasn't staying in a hotel. I also met a lot of the journalists who had covered the coup period, in fact, David Halberstam, Peter Arnett, Horst Voss, all these guys, I met them in those early days, Neil Sheehan, and so on, and I loved Vietnam right away, I had my first bowl of pho, the morning after I got there, up the street. I still remember where I did that, and so I stayed there a whole month, and I was I got a trip down to Cantau just to have a look around. I was hosted and taken out to some strategic hamlets which had been destroyed by the people after the coup. And I met an IVS volunteer, International Voluntary Services. That was like a Peace Corps, private Peace Corps. And I was always going to join the Peace Corps. That was my idea then, being a JFK idealist. And this IVSer said, "Oh, I hear that USAM, which is the predecessor of USAID, is looking for number twos in the provinces." So just before I left to fly back to Hong Kong, I went into the USAM office asked to speak to somebody about, they're looking for people. So I literally walked in off the street, and they said, "What are your qualifications?" And I said, "Well, I grew up in the Congo and I speak French." So the whole interview was in French. This American official. And then when I got back to Hong Kong, a couple months later, I get this big manila envelope, and it's a contract between the United States government and Carl Robinson for years' contracts. I went back to Vietnam. I took a year off university and went back to Vietnam. And I was sent to Gokong province, where I later met my wife several years later. This was the pacification program, but it was like, it was really, there were not many American advisors there. There were only two civilians and just a handful of military advisors. And it was really, and that's when the war really exploded, the Gulf of Tonkin and all that sort of stuff, the 64 presidential election. And it was great. I was working in the, out with the villagers and the hamlets and so on. And it was all about economic development, building schools and bridges and all that. So it was really grassroots, rice roots Vietnam that I knew, right? I was getting my feet muddy and everything. So that was my Vietnam, drinking beer ladu with ice, picking the flies out of it. And so that was my introduction to Vietnam, was working in the Mekong Delta. And then I went back and finished uni and couldn't get into grad school and went back again with USAID, and Gokong was opened again. I went back there, so I ended up resigning in protest over the way the war was going after the Tet Offensive. And then I had met Kim Jong and wanted to stay, and got a job with the AP as a caption writer.
Wow,
or a photo editor, actually.
And how long were you with the AP for?
So 68. So I was there with. I was there until 75, so 7 years, right?
And yeah, it's a long time.
Fall of Saigon. And then they brought me back to New York for 2 years. And then I wanted to go to Africa, which was blowing up then. They sent me out to the first vacancy, which was Australia. What? Australia? So I ended up down there. And after not even a year, they fired me. So I said, okay, stuff it. I'm going to stay here. It wasn't easy. That first year, I mean, it was all post you know, post-Vietnam depression. Her father ended up in a re-education camp because I couldn't get him out. It was really, but at least Australia, we could send letters and mail, letters and packages and so on. So I decided to just start my life again, frankly, in Australia with my wife and our then three kids. So
what? Why did you get let go after a year in Australia?
Even the AP, when they were countering the contentions of the Stringer, did a big 96-page report, and even they couldn't determine why I was fired. But I mean, that happens all the time, right? But I don't know. It was I've never got a proper explanation, and I think it would have been good to have had an explanation of some kind. But I think it was for the best, you know. I think I like to say I wasn't AP enough, and I wasn't wire service enough. But
wait, Carl, what does that even mean? You weren't AP or wire service enough. What does that mean?
Well, for one thing, I'd been a local hire, right? And I was hired as a photo editor, and by 75, I was a writer. So it was all on the job training, right? And I was also covering Laos and Cambodia, where my French was really useful. And so by 75, by the last couple of years of the war, after the 73 ceasefire, I was a writer. And then they didn't know what to do with me in New York, so they put me on the desk. But I hadn't come up through the AP state system, right? You know, you work for a local paper and then state capital, and then you move up the feeding chain. I think that was part of it. So, but I've never, you know, I think it was not being told is the most annoying thing. But I don't I don't regret it. It just gave me a new start. It gave me a new start to life. I think that showed some bravery, finally.
What did you end up doing after you were let go? What after that period? What were you getting into?
I sort of sensed something was coming because the president visited, AP president visited, and snubbed me royally, and we'd figure out how you could buy a business. So we opened a little what they call takeaway food shop, like takeaway or to go in America. So I left AP and we started this little takeaway food shop. And of course, we were illegal because I lost my work visa. So I applied for permanent residency, and they told me no. You got to go back to America and apply. So I said, "Oh, please let us stay." And it took a while, but they did end up letting me. And then so we opened this. And we call it Gokong Takeaway, you know, and Kim Jung was always a great chef. That's how she won my heart, really. And we started selling Vietnamese spring rolls and stuff like that. So we went from news to running a little grocery store, you know, where the residence was right behind it, and it's just what we needed. And then I ended up getting a job with the Sunday paper, which was great. So I was finally getting some experience chasing ambulances and using the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam, you couldn't use the phone. You didn't want to use the phone to talk to people. And then the Newsweek magazine came along and was looking for a stringer. We'd like you to be our stringer. So that was my great break. So through the 80s, I ended up working for Newsweek magazine. Covering Australia, New Zealand, and the whole South Pacific, and Antarctica, and Micronesia, and it was just what I needed. I think I was too angry and bitter about everything to come back and live in the States. It was my decision to stay in Australia was also very, I would say, political. I was really angry at how the war ended. I was very bitter about it.
Yeah. Carl, when you think about writing all these pieces in Substack, do you self-censor? to make it safe for yourself to go back and forth, go into Vietnam, come out of Vietnam, and not have any issues?
I am conscious of that, but I wouldn't say I'm self-censor. What I write is really common sense. It's really just pointing stuff out. And of course, people are being put in jail for pointing out common sense.
Yep.
You know, one of my Substacks, I followed one Facebook woman from Hanoi, all the way to, she's writing incredible stuff. It's all making sense. Or what about what it says in the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. And then one day she's, the police show up and they were heard from again, and I, in real time. I wasn't worried about writing that. It was just something that happened, right? Like, I don't really worry that much about it, frankly, because if they do want to do something, I guess I can't help it. But I'm pretty philosophical about going back to Vietnam. I think it's changed so much since we went back in 1995, 20 years after the fall, we went back. And we've been going back, but Vietnam has changed so much. I know you're younger. And when did you go back to Vietnam the first
time? Started 2000.
Okay.
So 25 years, 26 years ago.
Yeah, that's good. So, now with, mass tourism coming in, now everyone's going up to Ha Giang now, the British tourists even wiping herself out. I did motorcycle trips all over Vietnam and got to know that I really enjoyed getting to know the North.
Yeah.
The old enemy North. Because that's where the history of Vietnam is, right? I mean, going to the Bac Dang River and, where the two battles took place in Ngo Quyen's and Tran Nung Dao's battle. And then going even to Tran Nung Dao's a village in Nam Dinh, right? I mean, we showed up and there was all the descendants of his family having a festival. And we ran tours to Vietnam actually through the early 2000s for Australian Vietnam veterans. I think Vietnam's changed so much now. What is mass tourism and the way they do tourism in Vietnam really puts me off. I mean, I don't have to participate. participate in that because we've got our own little world. But it's just, if I have to say goodbye to Vietnam, I guess I will. But I've got great memories of, the whole experience.
Carl, you just brought up the North as the enemy, and I think that lives in our conscious as a child of the South government myself. That was often the frame of the North is the enemy or the evil sort of but things are changing. Do they change has it changed in your mind? Has this narrative of the enemy been reframed in your heart and mind because of your time, your distance away from being a product of the South as an American? Have you changed your views on it being the enemy, the North?
I really had a hard time reconciling myself to the guys who won the war in 1975. I was a conscientious objector actually, and I didn't have to go in the military, but they did try to draft me in Vietnam to do my alternative service, like with IVS. But my perspective on Vietnam was always that it needed to be neutralized, right? That it needed to be 1962, De Gaulle made a famous speech in Phnom Penh about how Vietnam should be neutralized. And they did neutralize Laos, but they just that just turned into a secret war. But that was always my, this was like, you know, big men who staged the 63 coup was aced out by the Americans because he was tending toward neutralism. You know, let's talk to the North, let's work out a solution. And then I saw the whole thing transpire where they brought in Nguyen Khan and all those right wingers and ended up with Thieu and Key and that mob. I mean, I was always, I never had much time for the, South Vietnamese, you know, that we were, that we put in there, right? The South Vietnamese, I love the South Vietnamese that I was hanging out with, but gosh, they were so poorly served, you know, so poorly served by their own government. But the North was much more of an abstraction, right? But they were the ones who, they're the ones who really started the war, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, in my Southern sort of perspective, they're the ones who want to have a war, and the Americans are quite willing to play it, you know. And I think, I mean, my reporting with the AP, I didn't do much war, you know. Don't call me a war correspondent, but all my reporting for the AP in Saigon was about people stories and also internal politics. And I became quite close to the third force, the neutralists around Big Minh, who was still hanging out there and who ended up being the president for like 2 days in the end, right? But these are all my friends, right? All, again, French speaking, right? So my hopes in the end in 75 were, okay, the people were tired of the war, the war weariness, and the communists were promising that it would be a time of peace and reconciliation. And gosh, I mean, enough people died between 73 and 75. And there was an opportunity in the Paris Peace Agreement for a coalition sort of government. The Americans and Thieu, you know, kissed them off. No, we're not going to do that. So, but I had hopes for better things from them after 75. And I, you know, and like Kim Jong's own father, he was sort of that neutralist disposition. Oh, the communists aren't going to, you know, okay, well, we are going to have peace. Everybody wanted peace so badly. They believed what the communists were saying. You know, that you could say the smarter ones were already out, right? The ones, especially the ones who had fled south in 54. No, you know, they were out of there quick smart. They could see it. But I was just, and then when they did take over, Kim Jong's family couldn't get out. He ends up in a re-education camp, and he wasn't even in the government or in the military, right? So there were a lot of Southerners who believed that story, that things would be all peace and reconciliation. Well, gosh, it still hasn't happened, really. Honestly, they've admitted that they were a bit too mean after 75. They've done that. But you know, they haven't really, they still need to take that step of, okay, you know, there was a Southern side, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, they stopped calling you Minh Wei, you know, devil, whatever.
Yeah, Minh Wei is traitors.
I still think that maybe, you know, they still need to take that step, frankly. And just getting back, there were a lot of Southerners, and then when they saw what the reality, that's when we got the boat people, you know, coming out, pouring out in droves. A lot of everyone gave them the benefit of the doubt. But I've met you know, just going around having coffee, I met one. It's very rare that you actually meet someone who was a Viet Cong, right? You meet lots of ex-Arvin everywhere.
Yeah,
And he told me that his father was a Viet Cong, and that the first thing he did in 75 was tell the kids to get out. but he is the oldest one stayed, and he's done okay. But
that's funny.
They still need to go that far. They still don't have. I mean, even Tô Lâm at the 50th anniversary thing last year, he said we are now mature enough to look back. Well. Okay, and I've used that quote in my Substack.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, let's do it, folks.
Okay, let me ask you something, Carl. Let me ask you something. Again, I remind the audience, child of the South, I just want to see things in all from all angles. What is the incentive of Tolum or the North to make a proclamation that the South existed? What is the reason that they should do it? What is the incentive that they should do it? And is it really something that they would benefit from making that proclamation?
No, I think you've answered your own question there. Of course, it's all about you know, unitary power. They don't want to give up power. There's no real incentive for them.
Sorry, I'm going to push back strategically. If they did acknowledge the South, don't you think that they would have win the hearts and minds of 4 million people overseas? And would it really damage internal politics in country? And I'm asking this in a very, it's wishful thinking, for me to say, hey, Tolum should make a proclamation that the South existed, two fighting, you know, civil rights, civil war, two factions fighting each other internally in country. We acknowledge the South existed. And that would be an incentive for like all these millions of overseas Vietnamese to come back and go, bravo. Like, it finally came out. Wouldn't it be a good thing for the government to do that? Or is it really this idea of unitary and they're crossing the line if they make that proclamation and piss a lot of people off in Vietnam that died, you know, in that war?
Well, I don't see him doing it. You know, I think a lot of people were hopeful when he came in that they would, okay, maybe not a proclamation, but at least more
acknowledgement.
More acknowledgement, but I think it's become increasingly clear. I mean, where is Tolum spending not just overnight trip to Beijing, but they're really laying on for him with 4-day trip. He's already done 2 high speed train rides. But I regret that it's going the other way, you know.
But he has mentioned in that speech when he came up a year or two ago, he did acknowledge that there is a diaspora, that we welcome the diaspora home, and we, you know, we consider all Vietnamese globally part of Vietnam.
Yeah, but it's all on their terms, unfortunately. And I think that they need to take that extra step. I mean, I think a real problem with Vietnam is, and this is quite bold to say, but there's lack of confidence there. You know, and even, you know, that, you know, it's still all sort of derivative, everything. I mean, including their system of government. They really need to come up with something, you know, something. It's like those silly Vingroup Italian villages on Fuquoc. I mean, isn't there a Vietnamese architecture you can do?
You know, right.
You know, I think because of the war, they've lost that self-pride. They need to have that self-pride again. And that really, I mean, what the system brought in after the war has been every person for himself, you know? It's just been there's no unitary feeling. They can come up with these celebrations like around the 50th, in Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City, and the 80th in Hanoi, where everyone's waving flags and they're doing public marches and, you know, I mean, people show up for anything, right? But I think they need to get more substance there, especially if they want to bring the very rich diaspora, and I don't mean just money-wise, but intellectually,
yeah,
you know, to come back. And I think that they I don't know how it's going to, it still has to happen somehow.
Yeah.
But right now the trend is unfortunately the other way around. But now maybe, you know, maybe Tolum would eventually, you know, now that he's has 2 positions, would be able to say, okay, now we're going to be honest with you.
Well, I think it's a power dynamic and a ratio that you have to make a calculation if you're in power. I think, honestly, I think that it's understandable that the calculus would be, how much power do I give up versus how much flowers I'm going to give to the diaspora? Because if I give too much flowers to the diaspora, the power gets shifted a little bit. And that is a problem if you're in power. You don't want it to shift too much, right? So you have to find this balance to say, hey, come home and hang out with us. You know, you are us and us is you, you know, that kind of like that soft line is like, yeah, we're all alike, but deep down inside the engine of identity, there's a clear line in the sand that we have to address. And I think that, by saying that, the other side, the South, you know, at one point, it was a real thing. It's hard because then you shift the power dynamic. And I think that that's a very real thing for the government of Tolum.
But it's also one of those situations, and I did address this with the phony reality that they paint. Because everybody knows what the truth is, right? I mean, go around and speak to a few grandpas in the North, as I have, right? I mean, sitting by the lake and some, I meet an NBA, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking the same language, right? We all got screwed on both sides.
Yeah.
The ones who fought the war are the ones who got screwed in the end. I mean, even the guys who won the war got screwed. They're out there. So it's one of those things, everybody knows what the truth is, and you can talk about it around coffee and stuff like that, but then there's this sort of phony reality layer over the top of it. It's like a balloon. You just want to stick your finger in.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm doing with my Substack, you know, just popping the balloon, you know, bringing the reality here. I mean, like, there was an announcement as soon as the day after Tolan became both president as well as the Communist Party boss, he announced that there'd be going to be an amnesty for the 30th of April, but it's not going to include people who were taken down by the 331 and one other one, right? So, I mean, if he really wants to do it, I think it could start with a gesture like, some of these, especially the best known ones. There was one fellow who, Tweeduk, I think is his name, who was a Nieman fellow and wrote two hot-selling books in Vietnam about the post-war period, Doi Moi, and he had two books that did really well. And then they ended up arresting him and putting him in jail because he questioned the growing power of the
Politburo,
the internal police, right? But I mean, this is the sort of, just symbolically, just let these people go, and let them go back like this woman I was talking about. You know, let her go. You know, let her go back to her kids. She has an autistic kid. She's kind of sad, you know, that had to leave with whoever. But just do some symbolic stuff. But no, it's going the other way, unfortunately.
Yeah, now we're moving into some hot water with all of that because, you know, you have the work of, civil rights, humanitarian sort of freedom of speech, you know, where do you draw the line with all of this stuff, you know, and podcasters like me or journalists like you who, you know, if you shine the spotlight too heavy, then we lose, you know, our ability to go in and out. You know, we lose our access to a place that we love so much. You know, so I think about this a lot, Carl. I don't want to piss anybody off. Just, you know, I want to go back to Vietnam as much as I can. I want to live there one day. But change happens.
There is a lot of creativity there, you know, that you're obviously involved in. But even they have to, as you know personally, you know, drinking cafe with them, you know, what their boundaries are.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to work. I think you know, from my experience, you know, being in Vietnam and knowing the Vietnamese world, they're okay. They're state run or state controlled newspapers, but they're not very brave.
I mean, how could you be brave?
There's still a lot you can do within the parameters that you have.
Really?
And they're not doing it. They're just like, you know, serving time until they're 65 and they can retire.
Yeah, but nobody wants to stir up the pot.
A Tui Chek could do a lot of good human interest stories about people without political nothing, but they don't. There's a laziness there. I think there are a lot of other creatives who are out there, probably mostly freelancing, right?
Yeah.
Did you see the movie Mui Da?
I haven't. I need to watch it. Yeah, Mui Da. I have to watch it. Yeah.
I only saw the controversy about it, but.
Yeah, let me let the audience know for anybody who's listening to this, wondering what Mui Da is, Red Rain, and I think it's now streaming on YouTube. It's a state-backed movie that did like bananas. It just did really high numbers at the box office. It was like the record box office, 30-something million in ticket sales. And, the government said, all right, enough. We've made enough money. We're going to put it out on YouTube and let it run publicly, and you can watch it. And it's a war piece that people say it's a really good movie. I have to check it out, Carl.
But there was a lot of compulsion about it as well. Like, you know, you had to go watch it. And you weren't allowed to criticize it. But what was remarkable was that this was about the Battle of Quang Tri, right, in 72, you know, the same year as the Napalm Girl, when the South Vietnamese took it back. And it portrays the remarkable thing I've heard about is it portrays the South in a bit, you know, a bit kindly. There's a mean one. There's a mean Southerner.
Yep,
You know, really bad. But the other one that shows, in fact, it ends with a brotherly theme or something like that, I am told. But what was interesting was that some NVA came out and said, look, the South Vietnamese weren't that mean. Right? So there was a conversation. And then, and you're right, blockbuster, right? You know, heavily funded. And, you know, I guess the North Vietnamese Army probably got lots of extras in that one. But it's the sort of thing that, you know, it was good to see. But at the same time, Bao Ninh's Sorrow of War was making in the news because he was, some people were complaining that he was taken off the list of the 100 most important, this was in the communist, you know, the Vietnamese side of people from the creative industry. And some people complained, so now they're only 99. Now there are only 99 famous writers and poets and things like that. But it was
Carl, how do we find your Substack? I'm not ending yet, but I, you know, want to remind the audience, where do we find your Substack writing?
Well, people are a bit confused about Substack, but you download an app and then you go to Carl Robinson and then you subscribe. Now it's free. I'm not doing this for money, but if you'd like to pay, I've had a few people who paid. But and that's how you, and then you subscribe, and then as a free subscriber, you get an email notification that I put up another story. Once you're on Substack, you can start exploring whatever you want, you know, geopolitics, the wars around the world, or entertainment news, or literature, or poetry, whatever you want. There's a huge list of interest that you put down there, and then you get notified by Substack of notes of what stories are out there, not just yours. But it's a great long form sort of journalism stuff. My stories run 1,000, 1,500, occasionally 2,000 words stories. So very, you know, so what you call a long read.
But they're quick. They're like four to six minute reads. That's considered long.
And it's totally your own work. There's no editor in the way or anything.
Yeah.
And you just put it up and it's not the sort of thing where you even get that many likes. I don't think many, you know, I'm not in it even for the likes, but I'm in it more for just the building up my viewership. And I'm glad that a lot of my new subscribers have Vietnamese names on them.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's cool what you're doing because, you know, you really get on the inside of like the mechanics of like how the government is operating. And, you know, it's I feel like you don't propagandize one way or another. You're just putting things out there. And I want to ask you this, though. What do you think makes a good journalist?
As a self-taught accidental journalist, I think you got to have that curiosity, you know, about things. Well, first of all, you got to follow the news. I think you need to have a curiosity about you and you know, a certain spontaneity about it, you know, the ability to express yourself. I think people can be writers and not know it. I mean, I used to joke that I used to be a great writer, and then I went to work for Newsweek when they edited my stuff. But I feel like my writing now has never been better in my whole life, right? But I mean, because when you know the AP, you're writing to a style, and even Newsweek, it's a certain style. But now with all these platforms out there like Substack, you can start your own Substack and just start putting up, you know, whatever you want to talk about. I mean, it's just a variety of stories out there, you know, from really serious to just really personal stuff. You know, and there are not many Vietnamese voices there, although I did find one this morning who was talking about her mother, her strict mother.
Yeah, I'm so close to getting on that platform. I think it's an amazing tool to, you know, get our thoughts out. And I think that everybody who is on Instagram or, you know, a personality should get a Substack to write regularly. I think it's a good exercise for our modern brains. I think AI is becoming, you know, so popular and inherently needed in our ability to put our thoughts out there. But I think it's making us, it's creating harm for our thinking brains. And I think that writing something on Substack, not even to make it public, but just like writing it so we can keep records of it. And then one day being strong enough and confident enough, I'm speaking for myself, to make it public.
But you can use Substack for like, I mean, I don't, there are a lot of stories. I mean, every Vietnamese is a story. I mean, I don't have any problem talking to Vietnamese, you know. Everyone's a story, you know. You just need to tell it and get it out. And what you're doing with your project, you know, just write it down, start it. It doesn't have to be one story. You can write about, you know, what it was like, you know, going to a French school in Saigon and Da Da or something and take your life from there. Your own, I think these memories, I think you're doing an oral history, right?
Right.
But I think people should be encouraged to write it and put it up on Substack, or maybe they send it to you to put up on your Substack, right? But there are a lot of memories out there. I mean, I've been, you know, we've been hanging out, of course, with, you know, I live in this Vietnam, I've been hanging out in the diaspora here. But everyone's a story. I mean, like that fellow who remembered me from Gao Cao in 1964, that I looked up in when I was in Southern California, whose grandson had seen a Substack, and he said, "Are you the Carl Robinson my grandfather is always talking about?" And I said, "Yeah." So I made a point of going to see him when I was staying with May for a couple of days, and he's going on dementia. That's the problem at our age.
Yeah,
he was so, I didn't know I was that important to his life. I just, you know, treated him like a normal guy.
Carl, I'm reading your Substack and I'm like, you're in your 80s and the writing is still so lucid, and the thoughts and, you know, the way you put everything down is, you know, I'm so impressed and inspired by the work that you do at your age.
Well, that's to ward off the Alzheimer's.
Yeah. And that's, I think, is important. an exercise to ward off dementia, Alzheimer's, any mental issue. I think if we're conditioning our brain to think critically and put it in writing, and then you're editing it and you're watching it and you're looking at the words, I think it creates a sort of buffer for mental health problems in terms of a declining ability to think.
Exactly. There's nothing like, I mean, I get a lot of joy when I hit that send button. Off it goes. But even greater joy reading it the next morning. I said, man, that's not too bad. So I think it builds your confidence, right?
Yes.
I think it's a confidence builder. I think, it's also when you're writing to make a living, it's different from what I'm doing now.
Right? Yeah.
I can have an opinion.
That's the beauty of what we do today.
You weren't allowed to have opinions.
Yeah.
But I respect that. The journalists, I think journalists should not be allowed to have opinions. That should be rule number one. You're not allowed to have an opinion.
You just got to report.
Yeah. Report on what you see and talk to as many people as you can. But I think journalism sort of suited my personality in a lot of ways. I never spend much time with just hanging out and talking to people very long.
Yeah.
Okay. That's got a good quote. Okay.
Talk to somebody else. I really encourage our listeners to check out your Substack, Carl Robinson. It is an inside peek into what's happening in Vietnam. And I think it's safe enough and dangerous enough at the same time to keep you really engaged as a reader, because I think that the reporting and the your ideas are fair. And I think it's I highly encourage everybody to check you out. And Carl, thank you so much for coming on today. It was a pleasure. And I hope that, you know, we stay in touch in the next, 10, 15 years of you coming back on with more stories about Vietnam.
Well, we'll have to meet in Vietnam. I don't know when I'm back. I very rarely come back to America.
To the U.S.
More often.
Yeah, I would love to take my kids to Australia.
Home.
Yeah.
To this home. But I think Vietnam is my real quê hương.
Your real quê hương. I love that. Yes. Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Good to chat.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.